Welcome to the Healing Trauma Podcast. I'm so glad you're here. I'm Monique Coven. I'm the host. I'm a certified trauma recovery coach. I've worked for over 25 years as a social worker, and I'm a survivor. The Trauma Healing Podcast is for those who are healing trauma and finding ways to navigate through this messy, uncomfortable, and challenging recovery process. The intent of the podcast is to provide helpful information to validate, inspire you, support you on your healing recovery journey. You're going to hear stories from other survivors, trauma experts, and trauma therapists in the field that will provide information on effective trauma healing modalities, tools, techniques, skills, all in hopes of helping you heal. If you'd like to find out more information on trauma recovery healing, please go to my website at www.cptsdcoach.com. I also have an Instagram and Facebook page at cptsdcoach. It's very common for trauma survivors to feel like they're ping-ponging between overwhelm and anxious and shutdown. We now know ways to begin to heal trauma, and this is the kind of work that I do. If you'd like to find out more about trauma recovery coaching, you can visit my website at www.cptsdcoach.com. Today's episode, we're sitting down with Nakuset. And she is one of the many Indigenous children removed from their families as part of the 60s scoop and placed into the child welfare system. She was adopted by a white family in Montreal. She tried to blend in, and no matter what she did, she always felt like she just didn't fit in and wasn't good enough. When she was 18, she left home and she started to learn about her identity as an Indigenous person. And there are so many social issues impacting the Indigenous community, as we know. And Nakuset spends time working on all of them. Once she identifies a concern, she steps in and she creates solutions, which is just amazing. She's the executive director of the Native Women Shelter in Montreal, including Resilience Montreal, a wellness center for the homeless, and so much more, as you will hear. So let's get started. Enjoy this conversation. Hi, and welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm just so excited. You know, I have been wanting to get somebody on the podcast to talk about, you know, some of the issues that have been, especially in the news recently, with the Indigenous children in the residential schools, and it just kind of didn't work out. And then a friend sent me your YouTube video. I saw your story, and I was blown away. I said I have to speak with her and bring her on. And you were so kind and willing to come on. So I would love to get just right into it. So maybe you could explain a little bit to the audience about your history. You know, where were you born? Where did you end up? You know, those kinds of things.
Okay. So I was born in Thompson, Manitoba. I am originally from Lac La Ronge, Saskatchewan, Treaty 6. I'm Cree First Nations. My mother went to residential school. She went to the Prince Albert Residential School. She had seven children that she could not take care of because of her experience at residential school. By the time, like in the 70s, the government created the AIM program, the Adopt an Indian or Métis program. So I was put into that program when I was about like 2.5 years old. And for all my siblings, I was the only one that was actually adopted into a non-Indigenous family. So This is part of the 60 scoop, and the government created first the residential school systems the turn of the century, so the late 1800s, and closed the last school in 1996. And then they started implementing the 60 scoop in around the 1960s. And this was a initiative by the government to assimilate indigenous children through adoption into white families. So my picture ended up in a catalog that was sent to Jewish Family Services here in Montreal. My adoptive parents went through the catalog and stopped when they saw my picture and said, "We'll take her." And I was flown down from Thompson to Montreal. I was just about 3 years old. And I've been in Montreal ever since.
Yeah. And you know, it's very interesting because I never knew about the 60 scoop. It was my first time hearing about it. I saw pictures actually in your, you know, in your video of the way it was like a catalog, and you sort of could, and even the descriptions, you know, this one has dimples and big brown eyes, and it was just, yeah. So maybe I could just start with a question. So your mother was not able to care for you, and so and the children, and so they were adopted out.
Yeah. So my mother, my biological mother, because of her experience at residential school, which was horrific, right? You have to understand that the indigenous kids at residential school were mistreated, were starved, were physically abused, sexually abused, just enormous amount of abuse. So she lived through that experience. And then when she started to have children, she wasn't really ready to have children. She wasn't in a good headspace. And a lot of indigenous people, unfortunately, I don't like to say a lot, but the truth is that sometimes when we need to self-medicate, we'll turn to drugs and alcohol. And that's something that my mom did as well. So she would basically go out and party and leave me and my siblings alone. And my older sister, Sonia, was the one who took care of me. And eventually social services did a home check. We were not living on a reservation. We were living off discovered us and put us into a foster home. And honestly, I had been in many different foster homes from the beginning of my life until I was finally, put into the AIM, Adopted Indian or Mentee program. So, that was the beginning that was my experience. My other siblings just sort of bounced around from different foster homes to different group homes and back to my mother. That was their experience.
Yes. Yeah. And, I was listening to how your sister, I think you were not even three and your sister was only 3 years older. So she was six. And she was trying to care for you. And one of the things I noticed in one of your videos, you talked about wanting to know more because you were so young. You really didn't have any memories, and not just because you were young, also because it was traumatic what you had experienced. And so you really wanted to find out what happened. I have no memory. I have no records. And so you were hoping to find out more of your story from your sister. So were you able to do that?
Yeah. I mean, when I finally, Sonia spent many, many years looking for me after I was taken away. And what she would do was share horror stories, though, like not good stories. Like the first time I ever spoke to her on the phone, she said to me, "You know, I took a lot of beatings for you." And you get like this instant guilt, right? Because like I have no recollection of that at all. And she is trying to tell me that I was there to protect you. And what's interesting was I sent you that case study, right? When I was young.
Yes,
well,
you did.
Well, when I finally met Sonia, when I finally met her, I showed that to her because I was trying to sort of piece our history and to show her that I had some kind of paperwork on it. So when I showed it to her and she read it and she saw that I was beaten, she fell to the ground crying. And she was devastated. And I was like, oh my God, no, look, I'm fine. I'm fine. Like, don't cry. Like, she thought that she took all these beatings from me. And the paperwork showed that she didn't. And she felt so bad. So, you know, it was just a very difficult situation for both of us to be in. One, because when I was removed, nobody would give her any answers. So she woke up in the morning and I was gone. We slept in the same bed every single night. And when I was not there, but I left my, I had some kind of like stuffed animal. I left that behind. That was her first question. Why did she leave the stuffed animal? She went to the foster mother and said, where is she? And the foster mother just didn't bring it up. She assumed that our mother came and just took me and brought her back home, and she was left behind. When she finally ended up speaking to our biological mom, she had no idea where I was, right? So I think that really that put a lot of stress and sort of anxiety on her shoulders. And then with our other sister, Rosemary, when her father and our mother separated, he took Rosemary back to Germany. So Sonia, when Sonia is 6 years old, I get removed. When Sonia is 10 years old, her other sister gets removed, and she's just wondering, why does everyone leave me? So it really shaped her, these experiences, and not in a good way.
No, and I just wanted clarification from what I was reading. Did she stay in foster homes, or did she go back to your mom when you got adopted, your birth mom?
Back and forth. Foster home, back to my mom. If my mother was abusing her, she went back to the foster home, or she ran away, or she was in a group home. Like, she went everywhere. She's you know, you think of like a whatever, one of those games where you play with the little ball that runs everywhere there. Like, you know, those games.
I don't know. As you're talking,
you know,
I'm just
pull it and it would go all the way around. Like,
I don't know.
You
I'm
call
thinking,
those games.
Yeah. Oh.
Like a ping pong ball, or, you know, like whatever it is from the arcades that used to have, right? Like, you know, one of those games. Like, she was all over the place. And, you know, it really affects people differently. So what does this experience do? Do you take the experience and then replicate it, or do you choose differently, right? And I just feel like a lot of the times we have a tendency to just replicate because it's what we know. And that's it's a learned behavior. And, you know, throughout the years when I would talk to Sonia, once we, you know, when I was 25 or around 25, when we got reunited, we wrote all the time. We talked, we wrote, we got together, you know, a couple of times. But she would definitely explain to me what was going on in her life. And there are times when she would blame our mother for why she does what she does. And I would play devil's advocate with her. I'm like, well, I had the same experience, but I choose not to live that way. So, you know, like, if she would sort of, you know, also choose alcohol to sort of self-medicate as because our mother did that. I'm like, but I don't do that. So you have that choice. But, you know, I think that when mental illness comes into it as well, you probably just reach for the closest thing and the cheapest thing that's there to sort of drown out that pain. And my sister lived in a lot of pain. I think we all do, but we just find other outlets, right? Like, I have the workaholic. I'm like, I want to save the world. That's what I'm going to do with this, you know, with this pain. I'm going to turn it into something productive. But I'm not sure what that's all about. Whether, you know, I think Sonia was going down that path for a while, but something else, you know, the whole relationship with her children was very difficult. And, you know, she was very, very brave in the way that she knew that she had her limitations in parenting and chose to give up her children as opposed to having her kids taken away. But that left a ripple effect with her children as to why did you give me away? So, Yeah, it's anyway, that was a really long answer. I'm not sure if I'm going off the
I don't know, topic. But I'm following you. Oh, yeah. And sadly, it got to a point where it was just too much for her.
You know, what was really sort of the nail in the coffin, which is like a terrible, you know, analogy to use, but when she had been looking for Rosemary for years, and she was telling me about her other sister, Rose, and, you know, she used to call her Snow White because, you know, Rose was half German, half Cree, and she had very dark hair and very lichen. And she was always telling me about this other sister that in Germany, and I was like, like, it didn't really mean very much to me. I was so close to Sonia that I was like, yeah, we don't need another sister. It's looking for her. And she actually reached out on Facebook. She found her on Facebook and was leaving her all these messages. But the thing with Facebook is that if you're not friends with a person, it goes to the junk or something. It doesn't actually get to you. So for almost like 2 years, she had been writing to Rosemary, and she was really hurt that Rosemary wasn't writing back. So then I was writing Rosemary, and I was writing it sort of in a more official manner, like, I am the sister of Sonia and you, and she is trying to reach out to you, and you are not responding, therefore, you know, taking it sort of in a different manner. Because I didn't like seeing my sister hurt. But when Rosemary finally got the, you know, all the text, all the messages, like, it was like a floodgate, and she was so happy. And what was really neat was, you know, Rosemary and I actually look alike. I don't find I look much like Sonia, but me and Rosemary actually look alike. And she was just so grateful to have that reconnection. So we had this real happy reunion for a little bit, because Sonia, it's sort of like looking at the glass half full, right? Sonia was like, but what about everything we lost? What about everything? Like, why did we have to go through this? Why? And it actually just put her into a depression. And then what was hard was same thing happened to Rosemary, but she went into a depression that all the knowledge of everything, plus there was a lot of media involved, and all of a sudden, you know, she has these two sisters and we're doing, you know, TV interviews and all this stuff. Her whole life changed as well. And, you know, she ended up, you know, breaking up with her partner, losing custody of her child. And I'm thinking, wow, like, we are really just recreating this wheel. We're like, you're not supposed to lose custody of your child, right? And I was in the middle trying to hold both of them up. But, you know, I'm not, you know, I can't, right? Like, I thought I could. When my sister, you know, wrote me and told me that she was going to kill herself, I was like, whoa, like, I should be that person. That saves her. And I remember that she sent me this like suicide video and explaining in specific detail about why she was doing it. And, I caught her in time and we communicated for like 2 days, and I gave her, you know, I even called her children and I was like, please go find your mom. Like, she's in a really bad place. And they were like minimizing it, thinking like, oh, well, no, she always has these, you know, suicide, you know, like, you know, calls for help, but doesn't actually do it. But I took it very seriously. And, you know, it's not even like I could just take a plane to find where she was, because I don't know where she is, right? Anyway, she promised that she would not do it. And then, so I was happy that she said she wasn't going to do it. And then she sent me this, you know, text 2 days later. And she was like, I love you. And I wrote back, I love you. And I almost wrote, don't do anything stupid. But I thought if I wrote that, I was going to alienate her. But that was her goodbye to me. And, you know, she basically said, because I seem to be sort of like a public figure here in Montreal and people seem to be interested in my story. So she was like, use that, use those connections to bring awareness about what 60 Scoop does to, you know, our people, how it affects us, you know, and that sort of became like, okay, well, now I'm going to honor my sister's last wish. So I guess a kind of, you have some time to grieve, but you kind of take that grief and you sort of morph it into something, you know, that can make positive change. So that's why doing the documentary was really difficult, because, you know, I was without my bubby. And my bubby led me to Sonia, right? And then I had Sonia as a real incredible support. And now I have neither. So, you know, I'm grateful for the relationship that I had with both of them. And, you know, I'm grateful that I have my beautiful children, and I'm grateful that I have my job. So, you know, things are, I'm in a good place, but the realities of the sort of absence, you know, are not lost on me.
Yeah. We didn't even get to the part about your amazing bubby. That was the one person that was she was such a shining light for you. We didn't talk either about your adoptive home, but I don't know if there's anything you want to share about that experience.
Well, I was adopted by this Jewish family that didn't have really any inkling about what it was like to... to bring an indigenous child into their home, especially one that had lived through an enormous amount of trauma, right? They just thought, oh, she's so cute, just bring her in and it'll be fine. And I think they used to describe me as the three-year-old teenager, because I was very quiet. And I was also kind of mute for a while. I didn't speak, right? And they really didn't understand that. So I think I came in as like a real question mark, and they sort of struggled with how they were going to sort of relate to me. But my buddy, every time I saw her face would light up. She was so happy to see me. She was always just fun to be with, and just like, you know, love, like overflowing love. So I was super close to her, and, you know, I needed that kind of attention instead of like, ooh, what are we going to do with this child, to have someone who was thrilled about your presence. That's what she was to me. So, so we were incredibly close growing up, and, you know, I left home at 18 because it was just something that you get to do when you're 18. You don't have to be staying with the family anymore. I understood that I was, you know, adopted, and that, you know, as soon as you're an adult, you can leave. So that was the plan. And I waited until I was 18 and I was gone. And the thing is that usually in Jewish families, you don't leave unless you're going to, you know, Sejep or university, or you're getting married. Otherwise, you don't leave. So there was a lot of questions when I suddenly left. And I think that their sort of response was, we're just not going to talk about it. Like, so I am never brought up in conversation since I left. But when I did leave, I spent a lot more time with my bubby. So I spent, you know, easily on once a week, I was over there for weekends, for whatever. And, you know, she was the one who, you know, helped me find my indigenous family, especially when she knew that she was, you know, diagnosed with cancer, and that, you know, I was sort of her lifeline, and she wanted to replace that lifeline. She's like, I'm not going to be here for you anymore. So let me introduce you to your real family. And we had, you know, that took some time to find as well. But that was a real gift for her to like send me away. You know, I spent probably about, you know, a week or 2 weeks, you know, between Flin Flon and Winnipeg, and, you know, to meet my other siblings, because I have a lot. You know, the excellent thing was that I got my Indian status. When I became a status Indian, that meant, you know, through the treaty, because I'm Treaty 6, right? So that meant that I can have post-secondary education. And because I left home and I had no money, going to school was going to be a difficult thing. With my treaty money, I could go to any university as long as I was accepted. And I did, and I got my education. And through my education, I started working at the Native Women's Shelter. And that was in 1999. So I've been there ever since. And I've been able to sort of, you know, climb the ladder. You know, became the executive director in 2004. for. And, you know, I absolutely love my job. I feel so lucky to do it. And, you know, it's the kind of thing where it's like, wow, I get paid to do this? Like, this is awesome. And I've been able to sort of build bridges with different, you know, institutions, organizations, you know, to support Indigenous people. So yeah, my bubby was definitely like a huge part of that, because I really was in a lot of self-hate for many, many years and not knowing whether or not I was going to make it. I really, you know, and even people like who bump into me were like, yeah, when I knew you in high school, I thought you were going to just kill yourself. Like, we did not think you were going to get out of it. We saw that you were struggling and nobody could really help. I needed to find that within myself and to like remove myself from that family. And, you know, I think I'm just really lucky to use the love that my bubby gave me to replicate that with my children, because that's not what my sister did with her kids, right? She replicated what she knew, but I just took the best experiences and replicated them and left the negative ones way behind, right? So, yeah.
I'm speechless. We talked before, and the things that you're doing right now for the Indigenous women in your area, Montreal, mm-hmm. and there's so much. Could you talk to us a little bit about some of those things?
One of the first things I did when I started working at the Native Women's Shelter in the role of executive director. So you have to understand that at the Native Women's Shelter, when you're working frontline and a woman comes into the shelter, you have to do some paperwork. And we ask probably like 5 pages of information. And one of the questions, which is super interesting, is, were you as a child in foster care? So the woman would say, yes. Do you have children? Yes. Are your children in foster care? Yes. And I was seeing this correlation that everyone who was themselves in youth protection now have children in youth protection. And I'm like, what is going on with youth protection that the system kind of just turns in a way where you feel like you're not going to be a good parent? Like, why is this increasing? It should be decreasing. So, you know, as a frontline worker, when I would go to youth protection and sort of bring an issue like this forward, they'd be like, ah, you're just a frontline worker, blah, blah, blah. And they would kind of minimize it, right? When I became an executive director, I literally went and said, I want to meet your executive director and I want to talk about why this continues. So that was literally like 2004. What is that, like 15 years ago, something like that? I mean, a long time ago, 16 years ago. So throughout the years, I've been really trying to work with youth protection. We had a cultural manual, right? So we have this manual. I can show you what it looks like. It's online, where any foster mother that was going to take an Indigenous child would look at this book, and it would be sort of like the Idiot's Guide to Raising an Indigenous Child. But that's not exactly friendly to say. So we call it just the cultural manual. But everything negative that I received as a child, I turned into something positive, right? So learning your language and cultural pride and saying words in your language and you know, role models, right? You know, like Gordon Tutu and Carrie Price and, you know, different, you know, artists and singers and whatever. So this would be helpful for the parents to be like, oh. And then I had like a collaboration agreement with Batshaw, so that when children were separated from their mothers and the children put into foster care and the mothers were on the streets or whatever, they could come to the shelter as a unit, and that we would use all our expertise to sort of strengthen them. So we had that signed many years ago, probably like 8 or 9 years ago. And then when like that collaboration agreement expired, and it's never been renewed. And even though I sort of go to youth protection with the intent of repairing the relationship and trying to offer support, it's usually like, it's not your job. It's not my job. I'm happy with the way things are working. No, thank you. So it almost feels like you're in the doorway, but they don't actually let you in. And that is incredibly difficult. And it just gets to the point where you're like, you know what, this is fine. I'll just do it myself. So the Native Women's Shelter in 17 months is going to open a second stage housing. In the second stage housing, if you think of the Native Women's Shelter as being like crisis, that's first stage. Second stage, you're out of crisis. Here is a place where you can live with your children for up to 3 years. So we're going to have like 23 units for women with children and single women, but we're also putting in social pediatrics. So the Dr. Julian Foundation is going to be on the main floor, and any woman that has an issue with youth protection can go downstairs, you know, work with the Dr. Julian Foundation, and they will have the, each child will have their own doctor, their own lawyer, their own social worker, their own physiotherapist, their own speech therapist. They will have a whole team around them, and they will go into youth protection and say, okay, now why can't the mother have the child back? Look how we have everything around this, you know, mother and child. So that is the only way to beat the system at this point, because I can't wait for youth protection to be like, you know what, today's the day we're going to treat Indigenous children in a good way, right? So we're offering that, but we're also going to open the doors to all Indigenous people in Montreal can use the service. We are creating our own solutions, because that's what we have to do. When you have things in like Quebec, like the Viens Commission recommendations, so that's 142 recommendations that's geared towards Indigenous people that were discriminated against. 30 of those recommendations are youth protection. Youth protection has not applied one, and that was 2 years ago. Then you have the Laurent Commission. Then you have the inquiry into how, the Inuit children at Batchaw had their education and language discriminated against. There was an inquiry. And it's like, when are we going to wait for them to be like, okay, we're going to follow all these guidelines. I'm going to, you know, I'm already 50 years old, so I'm not going to be around for another 50 to see this change. So you have to create it yourself. And this is the kind of thing that I do at the shelter. Like, that's just one project, right? I mean, we have to do this when it comes to missing and murdered. And that's why I have, you know, the Ishkwe project, because we're working with the police to locate missing and murdered women in Montreal and in Quebec. And then I have the Capitol Square project and the Raphael Andre Memorial Tent. And I have that other project called Resilience Montreal.
Okay, so, wait. It's so amazing. Could you tell us about the square? Because I know that's a square where some homeless women hang out. And you, I think it's located right in front of your office or something. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, so the Raphael Andre Memorial Tent is based in Cabot Square. So that is the square that is in front of Resilience Montreal, which is another organization that I started November 2019. I started that organization because Indigenous people lost a vital service called the Open Door, which moved across town and weren't able to advocate on behalf of themselves, usually for medical or addictions issues. And about, you know, 8 Indigenous people died within 3 months. So I had to push the municipal government to do something. And finally, we were able to put Resilience where it is now. But what happened in Montreal was that during COVID, during the curfew that was implemented here by the provincial government, they said that as of 8 o'clock at night, everyone has to be off the streets, including the homeless. But the whole idea of being homeless is you have nowhere to go. And an Innu man named Raphael Andre couldn't find any place to go and froze to death in a porta potty. And when stuff like that happens, it really hits me. I mean, I did not know Raphael personally, but there's nothing worse than thinking, you know, someone who's left their community to find a better life dies in a porta potty. Like, this is unbelievable. So, you know, I really sort of worked with some incredible people like Michelle Odette, Mary Goodleaf, and Ian Lafreniere from the Secretariat des Affaires Autochtones, and, you know, was able to get a tent, but also to bring in all different kinds of donations from the community to sort of pay for stuff and, you know, bring food in. And, you know, we started the tent in Cabot Square February 3rd, and it continues to be in the park, even though it's no longer cold. We've had over 6,000 people that have come and visited the tent. So there is a huge need. And now I'm working with the city to try to turn this into an actual building. How do we make this sustainable? So that's going to be pretty much my project for like the next 2 months is to find a way. And there is a way. There's a lot of different, you know, places in Montreal where it could happen. And we're also working with the communities, right? So Quebec has 11 different nations and about 50 communities. So anyone who sends their people to Montreal, we want to speak to the chiefs about this. You send your people to Montreal and they fall through the cracks. What can you do to help this tent? What can you do to help this create a building? Can you give us financial support? Can you give us resources? What can you do? So we're creating this strategy now where we're going to present to the city of Montreal and show them what all the 11 nations want to do and see what they want to do. Because really, it's not in my job description to do this, but you can't just turn a blind eye. You can't, right? And if I have the courage and the strength and the resources to do it, then hell, I'm going to do it. Sorry, I said the H-E-L-L word.
That's okay. I'm just like floored, and Sonia would be just so proud of you. And I just think your life is just, you know, what you're doing, your one life is doing so much for so many lives. It's just absolutely incredible. So yeah, it was such an honor. Tell us how people, if they want to watch your documentary, if they want to find out more about your work, how can they find you?
Well, you can always go to like the Native Women's Shelter website, so you can learn more about the work that I do and all the different programming that we have. People can always donate to the Native Women's Shelter or any other Indigenous-led organization, because we're always underfunded. Anyone who Googles my name will find a lot of different videos and articles. So I try to... I don't know if I try, but I am very active within the community. And I'm kind of that person that when it's so obvious that there's a problem, I look around and I'm like, is someone going to do something? And then I step up. So I always wait for someone else to do it. But if no one else is going to do it, then I lead the way. And then, you know, what I'm hoping is that eventually people will follow. People will be like, when I say, is someone going to do something? Someone else may step up. But we're not there yet. But that's okay, because I don't mind, you know, doing what I can, because I, in my experience of work, you know, like when I started the Cabot Square project, that took 4 years. When I started Ishkwe, that took 2 years. When I started Resilience, that took 6 months. So the more you do it, the more you invest, you know, over the years, things become easier, but you have to take that time. And, you know, one of my role models is Mary Two Axe Early. And she was the one who changed the law, Bill C-31, because what happened to her? So she was a Mohawk woman that married a white man, Indian accent. If you marry a white man, you lose your Indian status. So she lost her status. Her husband died. She returned to Ganawage. They wouldn't let her back on the reservation because of what the Indian Act said. So that took her 20 years to change. And I actually met her. And I was like, wow, one day I want to change the law. So I'm not there yet. Still got some time. But this is it, right?
You're going to get there. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for spending time with us. Is there any last words you want to say just before we close?
I think that, you know, what is going on now with these, you know, poor dead children that are found in mass graves, that we need people to do, to have some action. And action could be just writing a letter. You know, depending on where it happens in Canada, because it's happening everywhere, to make sure that, you know, the records are released, that the churches are letting, you know, finding the names of the children, of looking about who's accountable, right? Because I know that, you know, with, you know, the Second World War, they had the Nuremberg trials, that they took people out of old age homes and put them on trial. Like, this is something where people need to be accountable, because this was a cover-up. You can't put 715 children into a mass grave and not tell anyone. But that's what they did. So now we're finding these mass graves, and somebody knows something, and let's let's just put it out there for the world that this is the history of Canada, and then see how we can work with the communities to reconcile, to try to heal, to try to keep, you know, people accountable and to move forward. Because, you know, we don't have ill will. We really don't. We have lots of reasons too, but we don't. We want to work together. We want to live together in a peaceful manner. But, you know, what happened here was really devastating, and we need to not forget about it because the numbers will continue. So, yeah, that's it.
Yeah, and, you know, we were all shocked, but it's like, even now, I'm like, why aren't people still talking about it and freaking out like they were the first day? It's utter horror. There's no words to describe it. And I agree with you. They should be held accountable, even if they're 99, you know,
yep.
They absolutely. So anyway, thank you so, so much for your time with us.
Sure.
It's been an honor.
You're very welcome. All right.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Take care.
You can help support this podcast for the cost of a cup of coffee. You can find the link in my show notes at buymeacoffee.com/healingtrauma. Thank you for supporting this podcast.